Now, for those of you who did not begin your reading odyssey in the early 1980s or in the United States, these books were books where your story would come to a dramatic turn, and then the reader would turn to a different page based on her choice or his choice of what should happen next. The story would continue based on the choice the reader made. Beginning late Tuesday night, the idea of preaching to you on this Sunday has humbled me more than usual. We are at a tender time in our country, and there are many messages to share. I wish Pat in the church office could format a choose-your-own-adventure kind of bulletin so that those who felt pleased and proud on Wednesday morning could hear one sermon, those who felt paralyzed by fear could hear another sermon, those who were taken by complete surprise, another sermon, and those who wonder, why is everyone else making such a big deal? Can't we just all get along and move on? Could hear yet another sermon. Well, that's a lot of sermon writing. I don't have 4+ sermons on me today. There's one gospel and one sermon, even if we are many dozen sets of years. You may ask me later what ended up on the cutting room floor, or I am happy to speak with you individually about how your reactions to Tuesday's election integrate with your story of Christian faith. I realize not everyone here had the option of voting. We are a congregation of many immigrants and temporary guests who do not have citizenship. But even so, I've been here long enough to know that everyone has an opinion. What I do have is a vision from Isaiah, and it is one that I believe would speak to the hopes and dreams of everyone, no matter which candidate they favored. For our city or our nation to be a joy and its people a delight. For there to be no more sounds of weeping or of crying in distress. For newborn infants to be healthy and for old people to live out their full lives. To build houses and inhabit them and plant vineyards and to eat their fruit. To do work that we enjoy. For our children to receive God's blessings, to have a communication with God so open and close that God answers before we even call, and to have peace among those known for violence. This kind of dream is something that speaks to the heart of what everyone wants for their own lives and for their loved ones. People who voted for Trump and people who voted for Clinton want these things and are convinced that their candidate could bring it, or at least wouldn't take it away if they were lukewarm on their vote. And yet, on this week, following the election, where incidents of hate crimes have erupted, protests have filled cities across the nation, and families dread being together for Thanksgiving, knowing that some will gloat and others will condemn, the path forward to that beautiful dream of Isaiah eludes us. In our Go Do stewardship campaign, we have had much emphasis on the verb go. Last week, we listened as Jesus told us, "Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations." This week, Jesus tells us what we need to do. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Do this, and you shall live. These words give us a roadmap to that beautiful, peaceful dream of Isaiah. I love the signs I've seen before that say, "Drive like your children are playing on this street." You might be a safe and moral driver yourself, but loving your neighbor as yourself does not mean that we try to convince parents that their children are actually okay playing on the street when we know that our neighbor tends to drive that block like it is a NASCAR track, and that Aunt Eunice tends to text while driving, and that our friend Marcus drives while intoxicated. Loving your neighbor as yourself does not mean that you tell your friends who live on that block that their children shouldn't be playing in the front yard. Loving your neighbor as yourself means you hear one another's pain and allow it to matter to you. Make an investment in their well-being. For example, I heard my daughter's adored teaching assistant, who is a Syrian American Muslim, a U.S. citizen, and wears a hijab, say that her mother is so scared that our next president will make Muslims register in some official government database that she is considering returning to war-torn Syria. Chris and I talked and decided that if there is any such registry as was proposed in the recent campaign, we will find a way to publicly list our family as Muslims while still professing Jesus Christ as Lord in our hearts. And we hope that others would similarly scheme to put their privilege on the line if our rights as a family were at stake. Wednesday, I went out to do a pastoral visit to one of our homebound members. I had called her the week before to see if she would need a ride to the polls so that she could vote. She was already planning to go, she told me, and her son would be bringing her. But we made plans for a visit the day after the election anyway. I came to her Wednesday after staying up most of the night before watching the election, then teaching Wednesday morning Bible study to a group that needed to process the election. I needed to process the election, and I was spent. The church member welcomed me into her home. We sat, and we talked about what was happening at the church while she finished her lunch. My son tells me there's a rainbow banner outside the church now, she tells me. Yes, there is, I slowly reply. My son wants to know whether that means this is a gay church now, she asks me. I pause. I take a deep breath. I swallow. It is mostly straight people at our church, and they chose this rainbow banner, I tell her, to show the church that it is a welcoming place for the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community. There are plenty of churches around that are not welcoming, and this church wants to show that we are welcoming. My host dropped the subject for a while, and I began to relax a little as she told me more about what her family is up to. But then, out of nowhere, she picks it up again. You know, I'm glad that we have that rainbow banner outside our church. Welcome is why I came to this church in the first place, many years ago. And then this 83-year-old church member, who told me I could share this story with you, told me the story of how she had worshiped years ago in an Episcopal church in a neighboring town, and she had sung in the choir there. She told me that during communion, she was always the only one left sitting in the choir loft. You see, she had been baptized and confirmed in another denomination, so she was not at that time allowed to share in the Eucharist of her church. She came to the Presbyterian Church in Leonia and found that all are welcomed to the table if they feel called to share in Jesus' meal. She became a leader in the church, and when a small group of members was commissioned to write the history of the congregation, she jumped at the chance to write the first section of the church's founding. This member, Phyllis Sharp, took great pride in telling me how in 1899, 48 members of the True Dutch Reformed Church met with Presbytery representatives in a snowstorm to form a new church because their former church did not allow people from other denominations to share in communion. These 48 felt that God was calling them to open the communion table to any whom Christ calls. And we continue that tradition today in this church as we gather people from many different Christian backgrounds or even new to the Christian faith, as well as ages and languages and races that are very diverse. And we find our oneness in the body that is broken for us. May this meal feed us and give us a foretaste of God's dream promised in Isaiah. And then, may we hunger and thirst for this dream so much that we scheme and do just what it takes to make it happen. This dream is not a piece that God will just hand down to us. It is something that we must struggle to bring forth, because that is what Jesus calls us to do. In this time, it is important not only to speak about what we are against, it is also important to speak about what we are for. We have to share a vision and speak a dream that others find compelling enough to follow. In an interview with the late African-American poet Maya Angelou from the Diane Rehm Show, a caller asked her what advice she would give about forgiving others. Angelou's reply was, "Well, one of the things, Ms. Laura, is I've changed that word to make it two words and turn it around to give for. So, if I have someone who has embarrassed me or broken a promise to me, or betrayed me, or in any way hurt my feelings, I'll find something, a bag of potatoes, a bag of onions, and a roast, and give it to a needy family. And I say, I'm giving this for Joe, who hurt my feelings. And somehow, I am free. I'm not carrying Joe around on my back. I'm not tugging him along everywhere I go. He's not making me look old and tired and weird. I'm free of him. I have given for him. I don't know where I got that, but that's what I do." Pledging is a way of giving for God's dream for our church and for our community. It is placing an investment in our mutual scheme as we imagine how we might build God's dream for us here on earth. In recognizing God's dream for us as the one we should aim for, we place God as sovereign over any human ruler. We give for God, and in doing so, we free ourselves to love more generously. This is the one gospel we stake our lives on. May Jesus continue to show us how to do that and to bless us on our way. Amen.